In this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking a bit about the effort to decode the human genome, who it is that did this, how and why, what it means for the future. And our guest for the program is Kevin Davis. He's the author of a book on this subject. It's come out fairly recently. It's titled Cracking the Genome: Inside the Race to Unlock Human DNA. And it's published by the Free Press. Our guest, Kevin Davis, is the founding editor of Nature Genetics, which is a kind of a spinoff of the venerable journal Nature. He's co-author of the book Breakthrough: The Race for the Breast Cancer Gene. He's a graduate of Oxford, has a PhD in genetics from University of London. He pursued postdoctoral study at MIT and Harvard Med School before joining the editorial staff at Nature. He is at present executive editor of Current Biology and makes his home in Boston. He's talking with us by telephone, and questions certainly are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. That's our local number, but of course also we have a toll-free line. That means that people who would be making a long-distance call can use that, and we'll pay for the call. That's 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, and toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Mr. Davis, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you.
To begin, I think it'd be good to talk a little bit about, in a sense, establish where we are in the process.
Yeah.
I think folks will probably remember, in fact, just a couple of weeks ago, there was a lot of news coverage of a joint appearance by Mr. Venter and Mr. Collins, who were the guys who led these two teams, sort of getting together, officially announcing the publication of their findings. And
That's
there
right.
was some coverage of this. And there are some questions to be asked about where things are. But I think it's interesting that in one sense, it was celebrating a major milestone, that is, the arrival at this place that we had been aiming for several years now. And also, there's the sense that, well, in a way, we've just started. And in your book, I think the metaphor you use is halftime.
Yes.
So where are we now?
Well, the metaphor that you allude to is that essentially where this is halftime for genetics. It was a lovely phrase coined by James Crowe, who's a professor not far from you at the University of Wisconsin. Without getting into a sort of a long, tedious history lesson, genetics kind of began at the beginning of the last century with the rediscovery of the famous laws of Gregor Mendel, the basic fundamental laws of how genes are passed on. And we've seen a spectacular century of discovery. We had the discovery of the double helix, the actual structure of DNA, by Jim Watson and Francis Crick in 1953, which deservedly earned them the Nobel Prize. And in 1990, the federal government in the States launched the Official Human Genome Project, which was a $3 billion, 15-year effort to sequence every shred of DNA in our cells. It's a massive undertaking because DNA contains 3 billion letters. Those are the raw elements of the genetic code. And until we could spell those letters out and figure out what all the genes are that are encoded in our DNA, we really can't begin to tackle all of the health problems and to learn about how we develop and how we evolved. So there was many good reasons for doing that. And that program is directed by Francis Collins. He took over from Jim Watson in 1993. The technology problems and the sheer size of the effort that was required meant that progress initially was very slow. And that was where, in 98, Craig Venter jumped in and said, you know what, I think I can do this a lot more quickly and a lot more effectively with private money. So it set up this huge private-public rivalry, and although some frictions still exist, the competition, I think, has really been a very good thing. And as a result, we had, as you mentioned just a couple of weeks ago, these press conferences in London and Washington and many other countries around the world where both parties have announced the publication of their results. It's not the definitive human genome sequence. There are still quite a large number of gaps. But nevertheless, we have identified the vast majority of the genes in the human genome. And now we can really get going on with the next phase of of biology, which is to figure out what those genes actually do and how we can use that information to develop new drugs and improve human health.
Mm-hmm. And I think there's a very important point there that you've just made, and that is it, in a sense, answers the question, well, yes, indeed, we say that now we know what the genes do, but when we say that, what exactly do we mean? And do we, in fact, really know what the genes do? We can say this thing does this thing, but do we actually know how it does that? What is it that we actually know?
I think what we have now essentially is a parts list. So we know where the genes are. In other words, we have a linear map of all of the genes strung along all of the 23 pairs of human chromosomes in our cells. And so we have essentially a vast catalog of more than 30,000 genes. But about two-fifths of them, we've never seen before. We don't have a clue as to what they do. So we need to be careful in saying, okay, we've got the human genome sequenced, we know all of the genes, and we know what they do. We certainly know pretty much where they all are. There will be more to be discovered, undoubtedly, in the next couple of years. But we just still don't know a lot about what they do. And one of the surprises that came out of the human genome sequence is that although we have surprisingly few genes, the estimates are somewhere in the neighborhood of 30,000, which is a lot fewer than people had originally expected, the genes are actually quite complicated, a lot more complicated than in other organisms that we know a good deal about. And it's likely that for every gene, it can actually make a variety of subtly different proteins. Just so everyone is clear, genes carry the code to make proteins, and proteins are what we're made of. So even though we know the raw parts list in the sense of the human genes in the body, it can only begin to illustrate the complexity of the vast variety of proteins. And Craig Venter, who of course has to continue to elucidate his business model for his company Celera Genomics, is now making a big push, as indeed many other companies are, to say, you know, the genes are great, but what we've really got to get a handle on are the proteins. And there could be, if there are 30,000 genes, there could be 200,000 or 300,000 proteins that have various functions in the human body, and we have to get a handle on those.
Yeah, there's a wonderful quote in here from a particular scientist who said, we know that a Boeing 777 contains about 100,000 parts, but having a parts list doesn't tell you how to put it together.
That's right, and it's very similar. I mean, we can't underestimate the importance of having this parts list. I mean, to have the maps that came out in the issues of Nature and Science that were published 2 weeks ago are extraordinary, and I should tell people that many of these issues, if they are interested, are freely available. They can go to the websites of Nature and Science magazines, respectively, and certainly Nature was offering free copies. They printed thousands of extra copies, and as supplies exist, people can request a copy free of charge, and they are tremendously important and fascinating historical documents. Indeed, at a meeting I was just at, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, both Francis Collins and Craig Venter were signing copies of these issues. They're that kind of precious.
Mm. I want to go back to something that you've touched on, and perhaps you can talk about it a little bit more, because as I think about the coverage of these announcements that were made a couple of weeks ago, something that all of the stories mentioned was the fact that for a long time there had been this estimate of how many human genes there were, and I guess the figure that a lot of people used was 100,000.
Yep.
Could be more, could be less, but that was a figure. And that what we now can say is that, well, we think, in fact, that it's something like only 30 or 40,000, yeah, many fewer than we thought. And I guess my feeling, though, as I read a lot of those stories, was no one answered the so what question. I mean, it's so what? We thought there were 100,000. Now we know there are 40,000. Why does that matter?
Oh, I think that's a great point. Scientists had originally settled on this figure of 100,000, and there was some limited scientific evidence, but really it was just because it was a nice round number and it sort of sounded about right. I mean, so that's how that figure kind of gained a certain cachet. And over the last year or so, as more specific estimates came out in advance of the final genome sequence, the numbers were coming down, and so the 30,000 figure wasn't actually that much of a surprise. But you're exactly right, it actually doesn't matter that much, and there's been a lot of press, certainly in Britain, where when the story first broke, one of the newspapers was trying to make out that because we only have 30,000 genes, far fewer than we had anticipated, therefore humans are nature plays a much smaller role, and our development and our behavior is much more a question of nurture rather than nature. And really, it's a fallacy to make sort of a direct correlation between the number of genes and the complexity of the genetic program. I mean, there are some plants that have the same number of genes as we do, and yet we would like to think that we're certainly a bit more sophisticated and clever than a plant. So, as I mentioned just a minute ago, even though there are quite a small number of actual genes, each gene can be kind of exists in several different flavors, if you will. It can make proteins where it's sort of a, like if a protein is sort of, if we talk about a gene being similar to a page in a book, it's as if, you know, the last line has been kind of left off, or the last paragraph may have been transposed with a preceding paragraph. There can be kind of subtle or perhaps quite drastic errors in the way that gene is read out. So 30,000 genes almost certainly does correspond to a much higher number of proteins, so that because these proteins can be switched on at different times in the body, it really provides an almost incalculable degree of complexity in the human body.
Yeah. Another thing that we certainly mentioned in the stories, and again, I sort of felt insufficiently explained, was the implications of the so what question is the fact that there is a lot of genetic material that we have that appears not to do anything.
That's right.
But then again, one wonders, well, what exactly does that mean? Just because it doesn't seem to be doing anything today, does that mean it never did anything? Is it sort of waiting around in case we ever need it? Or in truth, could you get rid of it and we would suffer no ill consequences?
I don't think anyone's proposing to get rid of it, but certainly, as best we know, most of that DNA, the so-called junk DNA, as people like to call it, probably is essentially it's just noise. It's just material that has accrued during evolution. I mean, we are the products of billions of years of evolution, and if you're in any doubt about that, you just have to read the papers and see how similar our DNA is to that of other organisms, such as mice and chimpanzees and more primitive organisms, to just have that fact reinforced again and again and again. And as organisms have evolved, they have evolved because their genomes, their DNA, has duplicated, it has sort of been rearranged, it has been like shuffling a pack of cards, new genes have come in from various sources. So, and over the course of that process, and as organisms have experimented, some of this DNA has accrued and is just sitting there with doing nothing. But there were some surprises in the sequences, and there is now a new kind of respect for this junk DNA. And even though it makes up about well over half of our genome, there are hints that it may in fact not be entirely dispensable, and that some of the kind of the very repetitive stretches of DNA that don't code for genes or anything like that, they seem not to be strewn randomly through our chromosomes, but they sort of cluster around genes, suggesting that perhaps over millions of years they have acquired some sort of subtle function. They may help our genes work better or something. We really don't know a whole lot about it, but it's an intriguing fact that sort of evolutionary biologists will undoubtedly be getting stuck into in the coming years. Mm.
I'm sure this is the kind of thing that's guaranteed to start an argument, but is it the case, you think, now that we have perhaps a greater level of assurance or a little bit more confidence in the way that we think about evolution based upon the fact that it seems that when you look at what we know now about human genetic material and the genetic material of other living things, it seems that a lot of it is the same. And I don't know if that necessarily means that, not to suggest that human beings sort of lifted the DNA from bacteria and just made it part of us, but maybe it says that, well, there aren't that many different ways to do it. It would make sense that, right, and essentially all these living things would have parts of them that were
right,
that were the same.
That fact comes through again and again, and in fact there are pages in both papers devoted to looking at this, because when you look at certain classes of genes in sort of very primitive organisms like yeast or fruit flies, about which we know a great deal, and then compare corresponding genes with humans, you see not only tremendous similarities between the different species in a large proportion of their genes, but you see how in humans and in higher organisms, those sort of very basic proteins have been kind of adapted, almost as if, you know, the yeast uses a very primitive a Volkswagen model, and then humans have sort of developed the Lexus equivalent with a few more bells and whistles and a few extra little bits and some sort of, you know, some nice flourishes at the beginning and the end. But the basic core components are the same, and indeed we have many examples where you can take a human gene, for example, a key gene that Craig Venter is fond of talking about called PAX6. The name really doesn't matter, but it's a very important gene involved in eye development. If you have a mutation in this gene, it causes a disease, a genetic disease in humans called aniridia, lack of an iris in the eye. This gene, it turns out, works absolutely beautifully in fruit flies. And you can take fruit flies that are missing the equivalent gene, put the human gene in, and lo and behold, fully formed, beautiful eyes developed, emphasizing that over evolution, genes have been closely evolved and their functions have been retained, even though we probably have, you know, most people would think we have very little in common with a fruit fly. The other important thing, and this is a joke that Craig Venter made at the press conference recently, is that we talk about the genetic similarity between different species. Our closest relative on an evolutionary timescale is, of course, the chimpanzee. And Venter sequenced the DNA from five anonymous humans from different racial backgrounds for his DNA sequence. And he liked to joke that, you know, for the fifth person, they could have actually substituted a chimpanzee. And he doubted very much that anyone would have noticed, because chimpanzees are 99% identical at the DNA level to humans. Mm-hmm.
We're here and talking this morning. I should introduce again our guest, and we have a caller we can take. Kevin Davis is the founding editor of Nature Genetics. He's the co-author of the book Breakthrough, The Race for the Breast Cancer Gene, and is the author of a recently published book titled Cracking the Genome, Inside the Race to Unlock Human DNA, published by the Free Press. And we have a couple of callers here. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, 800-222-9455. I will start here with Belgium, line number four. Hello.
Hello. Mm-hmm. I have several questions about this, and most of them are extremely basic, I'm sure. And maybe other people may not totally understand these concepts either. Okay, we start off and you say we all have DNA. Well, okay, fine. I understand that. And we also all have genes, okay? And then somehow they're related. I'm not totally understand why they're related, but they are related. And then we have different types of DNA. Like, they talk about mitochondrial DNA. Then they talk about genetic DNA. And it seems though there's all different types. Is it all related? Is it all the same molecule?
It's not all the same molecule, but it's I think fairly simple to clarify that. I'll have a go anyway. Genes are specific sequences of DNA. So, in the nucleus, in the center, in the heart of every cell in your body, are the chromosomes. These are the units of DNA that are passed on from generation to generation. So you inherited one set of chromosomes from your father, one from your mother. The genes are simply discrete segments of those chromosomes. And in fact, one of the tremendously fascinating surprises that came out of the sequences of all of the chromosomes that was published a couple of weeks ago is that the genes actually make up just a tiny fraction of our total sum of DNA. We talked about junk DNA. That's far more expansive and far greater in quantity than the actual genes. But if you take your first chromosome, for example, chromosome number one, and you read the sequence of the DNA in it from one end of the chromosome to the other, you'll go for a long stretch without seeing a gene, and then you'll come to a certain sequence, and that's a gene. And then you may have another section that's does absolutely nothing that we know of, and then you see another gene, and so on and so on, a bit like pearls on a necklace.
So the DNA is a long strand, correct, and certain portions inside this DNA are designated as genes.
Correct.
And these must make some kind of unique pattern to make them noticeable that they're...
The genes are simply sections of code, a bit like a computer code, that carry the instructions to make a particular protein.
But how do you know that that's a gene and not the rest?
Ah, very great question. And the way you know is that there are certain kind of clues within the sequence. So, for example, if I'm reading the sequence and I come across the three letters A, T, G, that is often the way that a gene will actually begin.
Kind of like a starting point.
There's certain clues as you go through the sequence, and there's a huge industry now, a very high-paying industry of a cadre of biologists called computational biologists or bioinformaticians who are trying to recognize the key clues, the key little motifs, the key little signatures. It could be as small as three letters like that, or four letters, or 10 letters. These are the clues that indicate where a gene is, and there are a whole host of different software programs that scientists are using to try to predict where the genes are. But there's another way you can find out where genes are, and that is because when you have a gene, in order for it to make a protein, it is actually a chemical message is read off the actual gene sequence, and you can purify those messages. And in fact, this is how Craig Venter first sort of came to fame about 10 years ago. He developed a very simple method to purify those messages, which by definition are just sequences that correspond to the genes in our chromosomes. Venter's approach was, let's forget about the junk DNA. I don't want to spend all my time sequencing millions and millions of letters of junk DNA that aren't going to tell me anything. I just want to find the genes. That was a method he developed whilst he was at the NIH 10 years ago. And we can now take those sequences and sort of match them back to the genome sequence that we've now got at our disposal, and kind of lay one set of strands across, on top of the genome, and that also gives us clues as to where the genes are. And one final way of doing it is to compare our sequence with that of the mouse, for example, because any gene that is important, that has a crucial function in a cell, well, if a mouse has got it, it's probably likely that we've still got it. And so if you line up a mouse sequence with a human DNA sequence, some bits are going to be totally apparently random, but other bits are going to look very similar. And those are the bits that you're interested in, because those are the bits that undoubtedly correspond to genes.
So you have a long strand of DNA that makes up somewhat of a skeleton, and then you have individual genes that fit different kinds of portions of whatever...
To the naked eye, the genes are unrecognizable as such. There isn't like a sort of, they're not highlighted, they're not sort of asterisked or marked in any way. So if you just read the raw DNA sequence of one of our chromosomes, you, and indeed many scientists, would not have a clue where to go about it. So you need sophisticated computer programs, as I say, to kind of sift through the sequence and look for some of these special clues. And they can highlight where a particular gene might lie. But, and then you use these other methods that I've just mentioned.
And then you have the various types of DNA, like this mitochondrial.
Mitochondrial DNA is a special class of DNA. It's and I don't want to make this sound like a biology lecture. There are special sort of organelles, little tiny vesicles inside our cells that are actually the sites of where we produce the chemicals that give our bodies energy.
Oh.
And these little mitochondria do contain a very, very small circle of DNA, which is important. It's mostly been of use in recent years as a tool for studying human evolution, because it turns out that your mitochondria are passed down. Your mitochondria you inherited from your mother, and they are always passed down the maternal line. So we can actually study markers in the mitochondrial DNA and get a feel for how the female how DNA has been transmitted through the female line through hundreds of generations.
I see. So the mitochondrial DNA might deal more with the biology of how a cell works, and the other DNA describes whether we got red hair or...
It's not quite that simple, but I mean, the mitochondrial DNA is thousands of times smaller than the human genome. It's only about 16,000 letters. The human genome is 3 billion letters. So we knew everything about mitochondrial DNA years ago, long before we did the human genome.
I see. So it is a very complicated subject.
Oh, yeah. Well, hopefully the book will try to demystify some of it.
Thank you very much.
Oh, sure.
Right, thank you. And again, other questions are welcome. Our guest this morning, Kevin Davis. And if you'd like to read more about this, you can certainly look for his book, Cracking the Genome. If you do, by the way, his last name spelled D-A-V-I-E-S.
Yes, we Brits insist on pronouncing it David.
You must be contrary. The Free Press is the publisher, and we certainly would welcome other calls. 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL. Urbana next, line number one. Hello.
Yeah, I've got a couple of comments and then a couple of questions.
Okay.
Well, to start with, you kind of characterized this whole process as being maybe at the midpoint. Oddly enough, I just received a newsletter where a fellow called Carl Feldbaum, the president of the Biotechnology Industry Organization, said, if this were a marathon, we would just be lacing up our shoes, which is considerably less optimistic than what you've characterized it as. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, we can trade metaphors and analogies, all day long if we want. And I think the analogy I mentioned was sort of in a dry look at the field of genetics. We could perhaps say that we're at halftime. But from a biotechnology perspective, I certainly wouldn't take issue with the idea that we're just getting started here. I mean, the goal of biotechnology is to use genetic information to develop new drugs, and 100 years may be a very naive estimate as to how long it will really take to utilize and understand all this information. So. First of all, as we said at the beginning of the show, we have to figure out what all of these genes do. And there are companies, including Craig Venter's company, Celera, but virtually every other biotech company that you can think of, are now trying to figure out strategies to set about, first of all, cataloging all of the proteins in our cells and then figuring out how they work, what they do, what they look like. Proteins are very unlike genes, which are simply a string of letters, and once you've read that string of letters, you know what the gene is. Proteins are very complex, three-dimensional entities. Proteins fold in a variety of very complex and very specific folds and very, very, very beautiful ways. And we only know a small number of examples of sort of precise crystal structures of these proteins. And until you know, for example, and trying to understand how the AIDS virus gets into a cell, you need to know what it latches onto. You need to know the structure and the shape and the conformation not only of the virus, but of the proteins that it's sticking onto, a bit like a lock and a key. We need to know how the key gets into the lock and how it kind of triggers the lock. And so there are companies now all over the country that are trying to figure out that information, not just for sort of key proteins involved, as we know, in HIV and other infectious diseases, but for in every variety of cell, because that information is going to be vital in order to figure out how to design drugs to potentially block. For example, if you could find a drug that would neatly block the lock that the AIDS virus uses that triggers, then we might have a tremendously successful drug that would be more effective than some of the other drugs that are currently on the market. So there's a huge amount of work to do, and I do touch on that in the book.
Yeah, well, let me just say that, to quote this newsletter,
yeah.
They say the human body has upwards of 30,000 genes.
Yep.
There are 1,500 cell types.
Yeah.
There are thousands of diseases.
Yep.
And the average cell expresses over 10,000 genes
yep.
at different levels. So if you look at the different combinations that are possible, they go into the trillions.
Oh, that's right. And that's what we were saying again at the beginning, that even though everyone sort of focused on this number of 30,000, and it is misleading because, there are trillions, literally trillions of cells in the human body. Each different cell type, you mentioned 1,500, expresses a different combination of those different genes, and the genes don't all you know, come on at one time. They kind of they will ebb and wane as at different times as in the pattern of how cells grow and how tissues develop and so on. So I think the marathon analogy is great actually, because it's it really is when you lay it out like that, it's very humbling to figure out, you know, we should be celebrating this genome sequence, but I mean there is an awful lot more to do.
I still have my question.
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, they are that. I kind of wonder if we're not being sold a bit of a bill of goods here, because you were quite right to start out with the notion that, speaking of how many possible proteins there are,
yep.
You know, this huge variety. They just on a very simple basis, if you block a protein's action, and which, by the way, you don't have to be at the genetic level to find the protein and then find something that'll block it.
Quite right.
But if you block a protein's action, you know, even there, what takes care of that protein's function? You know, and if you drug a gene, what happens to the protein that it was supposed to produce?
Hmm. Well, there's an awful lot that we don't understand, and you see from the news. Let's go back a couple of years to the some of the drugs that were introduced, like fenfen, to treat obesity, and then doctors noticed that there were sort of devastating side effects with patients falling ill with serious heart and lung problems. So, you know, often drugs are introduced and we think we know what they're going to do, and it turns out that we don't. And drugs, we may have tested them in animals, but humans are not mice or rabbits or any other sort of guinea pig that is used before drugs come to market. And these unfortunate problems can arise. But I don't think I wouldn't be as negative as to say, you know, we're being sold a bill of goods here. Because we need the parts list. I mean, only I've read somewhere that only about 500 genes or proteins of the thousands and thousands that exist are actually targets of drugs. In other words, of all the drugs that are on the market today, they're only being targeted to the very tip of the iceberg in terms of all of the proteins that we could potentially be focusing on in order to render some sort of pharmacological benefit. And now that we have the parts list, we can begin to learn more about the whole variety of proteins in the cell, not just the ones that we've known about for some time, as you say, without any sort of reference to our genome. And this, in turn, will provide a whole host of new candidates for pharmaceutical companies and biotech companies to go after. So, I mean, it's a tremendously exciting time.
Well, good luck to you.
Thank you.
All right, let's go to, I think we have somebody here on a car phone, line number 4. Hello.
Hi. I have a question. My son was recently diagnosed with juvenile diabetes. We've been doing a lot of research on the Internet and read about stem cell research.
Yes.
And so that's more of, rather than a drug, it sounds like a cure, or at least that's how I took it, that maybe there would even be a way to cure diabetes. Is that close to what you're talking about?
It's certainly related. In other words, the human genome and stem cells are two relatively unrelated issues. The Human Genome Project per se doesn't have any direct bearing on stem cell research, but stem cell research is a fascinating area of modern medicine, which of course raises a variety of ethical,
yeah,
very profound ethical issues, and there are many people who fervently believe that we should not be using stem cells derived from human embryos. Mm-hmm. Others who believe, and there is some evidence for this, that we may be able to purify stem cells that exist in adults that nevertheless would still have the same properties. Stem cells are important because they're unspecialized cells, and so in principle you could take a stem cell, transplant it or use it in some way in a patient, and it could, if given the right sort of molecular signals, it could develop to be specialized in along a certain pathway. And of course in diabetes what you want is a healthy pancreas such that it'll produce insulin, which is the key hormone that modulates our body's sugar levels. In diabetes, the pancreas is often severely affected. The cells that produce insulin are destroyed. And so stem cells provide a very, in principle, a fascinating way of going about it. I'm speaking to you from Cambridge, Mass., and a researcher here at Harvard University just across the road from me, Doug Melton, is leading the call for this kind of research. He is pioneering the use of stem cells, not necessarily to inject into patients, but to try to find a way in the test tube of producing healthy pancreatic tissue from a naive population of cells. And this, in turn, could be used one day to treat juvenile diabetes. The Human Genome Project will fit in with this system in the sense that it will provide, somewhere embedded in the human genome, are the key genes that are involved in telling an unspecialized cell how to develop into a pancreas or a lung or a heart or whatever. These are very carefully programmed steps in human development, and somewhere in this parts list are the genes, and it's like looking for a needle in a haystack, and we have now researchers like Dr. Melton and many others have the clues to do this. To just get away from juvenile diabetes, there's also been very exciting progress actually based in Chicago, from Graham Bell, a researcher at the University of Chicago. He reported about 18 months ago that he had discovered a gene based on genetic studies in a Mexican-American population in Texas that is involved in type 2 diabetes, which is actually about 9 or 10 times more common than juvenile diabetes and about which we know very little. So the human genome is already paying off in the sense that we are sort of sifting through our DNA and hopefully identifying candidate risk factors, genetic risk factors that may, in the next few years, really open up the way to providing a successful cure for the disease. I mean, that's the hope, because it is a devastating disease.
Yeah, I think it was so surprising to me to hear that. I mean, the good news is they know now that it's caused from a virus, that type 1. And that, to me, was overwhelming when I found out that, you know, that it was something that he obtained from a virus. They just don't know how it happens. They do know parts of the genes, I guess, that are whatever that's flagged, and the propensity to get the disease. But beyond that, there's no, you know, they really don't have any other information. So I think that was fascinating to me. And but I appreciate the information.
You're very welcome.
Thank you for the call.
Thank you.
We do have about 10 minutes left on the program here. And again, our guest is Kevin Davis. He currently is executive editor of Current Biology, founding editor of Nature Genetics, and author of a book on this subject. If you're interested, you can look for it. It's titled Cracking the Genome, Inside the Race to Unlock Human DNA, published by the Free Press. And there are certainly time for other questions. 333-9455, toll free, 800-222-9455. One of the things that I think we've talked about, certainly you write about it in the book, the fact that The Human Genome Project got underway officially in 1990, and there was this 15-year deadline. The hope is that we'd be finished by 2005. Halfway through, only 3% of the genome had been sequenced, and a lot of people were starting to wonder whether they were going to be able to make the 2005 deadline. So then Venter comes along, as you said, and he's the guy who said, look, I don't want to spend my time sequencing the junk. Let's go for the genes. And that's why it is now we're done ahead of schedule, which makes me wonder why it is we didn't just do it his way in the first place.
Oh, no, let me just clarify something. What you said was correct, just that the chronology was slightly wrong.
Ah, all right.
He bypassed the junk DNA 10 years ago. So what he said 10 years ago while he was a researcher at the NIH was, you know, I'm just going to go after the genes, sort of the 2 or 3% of the human genome that corresponds to actual genes. And he developed a method that led to him being given many millions of dollars by a venture capitalist to set up a private nonprofit research institute with a for-profit component, which is now a publicly traded company, Human Genome Sciences. Venture has nothing to do with that company now. And they have built vast databases of all of the genes that they can get their hands on using that approach that Venter pioneered. But in 1998, and then Venter at his institute got into whole genome sequencing by sequencing the genomes of bacteria. And he used a very simple method, a method that many scientists and administrators felt would never work, and he proved them wrong. And now we have several dozen microbial genomes, including the genomes for cholera and tuberculosis. And these are very important in their own right because, you know, now we have the parts list of some of the most deadly organisms in the world. And again, that information is vital in order to produce the next generation of antibiotics and drugs and so on. But in 1998, Venter was actually approached by a company called PerkinElmer, a noted biotechnological manufacturer of high-tech equipment used in molecular biology research labs. And they said, look, we've got a new next generation DNA sequencing machine that we think in your hands could lead to the very rapid sequencing of the human genome. And Venter jokes that, you know, when they first approached him, he thought this was a prank and he would hang up the phone. But he knew these people, and finally he was convinced that they were serious, and he saw the machine in action. Indeed, it was many times more powerful than the previously existing automated DNA sequencing machines, and he was convinced that with enough of them, and with a suitably powerful computer that he had built by Compaq, and producing the same very kind of simple approaches to assemble the sequence that he'd used and pioneered and got to work so well in bacteria, that he could, within two or three years, put together the human genome. Now, there's one important thing that I don't think has actually been that widely reported, and this is important to note, which is that Venter has, throughout this process, had the entire use and disposal of the public human genome sequence. So even as though they've been accelerating their sequence data, they made a big play of releasing that information every night onto the internet. They would deposit their DNA sequence into a database called GenBank. And this is available to any researcher without any strings at all. And so Venter was perfectly at liberty and perfectly within his rights to use those data and supplement those data with his own data. Mm. So he's not done a completely independent sequencing effort. He's taken his own sequencing data and added it to what the public had. And so I think that's just an important point to make. But whatever the relative merits of these two data sets, even his fiercest critics, I think, would acknowledge that, you know, here we are at the beginning of 2001, and we have a fabulous draft sequence. It is not perfect. It is not complete. It will still take a couple of years. But we do have a very, very accurate, very thorough working parts list of the human genome. And we have that in 2001 rather than 2005, largely because of Venter's entry into this arena and the very... Very dramatic response from the public sequencers who really got their act together in order not to be left totally in Venter's wake.
Yeah. One thing that we know is that there's a great deal of money to be made as a result of what we have learned already and what we will learn. At the same time, there are people who would argue that no one should be able to own the human genome.
Right.
That it's something that belongs to all of us.
That's true, and that remains true. And no one is, in fact, trying to own the human genome. But there are companies, and Celera is not the worst offender, if you will, in this regard. That's how some people view it. There are companies... I mentioned Human Genome Sciences. There's another company that's been very successful in patenting human genes, is Insight Genomics in California. But there are other pharmaceutical companies and other academic groups, I should stress, who have been very successful in patenting genes where they think they know enough about the gene to claim an invention. In other words, the use of a gene sequence to manufacture a protein that will be used as a drug or to produce a screening test for breast cancer or whatever the particular use is. And I read recently that Human Genome Sciences has in clinical trial now a protein that was developed from one of these genes using the method that Venter pioneered. So there is a tremendous potential in this arena, but the biotech sector, I'm not a stock analyst or anything like that, but it is rather depressed at the moment. I mean, Celera's shares at one point about a year ago peaked at about $270 a share. Right now, they're trading at about $40 a share, and it was partly through concerns about rampant gene patenting, and a statement that Bill Clinton and Tony Blair issued around about a year ago that really sent investors fleeing from the sector because the president and the prime minister emphasized that the human genome should not be patented. And in fact, no one was trying to do that. It's so ironic. They were simply trying to take genes where they knew a good deal about the function in order to patent that. And I think that most people, even the public scientists, acknowledge that that is entirely fair and reasonable. After all, if we didn't have a patent system, we wouldn't have a pharmaceutical system, because no pharmaceutical company would be stupid enough to invest the hundreds of millions of dollars it takes to bring a drug to market if they didn't have 15 or 20 years of sort of an exclusive protection in order to potentially, you know, earn that money back. So we need patents. We need gene patents. The question is not whether we need them, but how much should you do? How much should you know about a particular gene function in order to be awarded a patent? And the U.S. Patent Office has recently made it more difficult for companies and researchers to get patents, and that has been warmly received. It was perhaps too easy until recently.
Hmm. We certainly know that disease is the result, in most cases, I guess, of a fairly complicated interaction between genetics and environment.
Yeah.
I think we're also coming to a greater appreciation that infectious processes play a very significant role,
yeah,
even in some things before that we wouldn't have said that they didn't have anything to do with. Having said all that, I mean, do we really think that, given time and effort, that we'll at least get a handle on the genetic part of this, and that diseases that do have significant genetic,
yeah,
components will get to the point where we'll be able to essentially get rid of them?
Oh, I see where you're going with this. I have no doubt about the first part of your question, that in the next 10 to 20 years, we will know vastly more than we currently do about the genetic component of disease. And it's not just the diseases that are clearly genetic, but it's probably every disease, it is widely argued, has a genetic component. If we talk about asthma or diabetes, that we had a call about that earlier, mm-hmm, or multiple sclerosis or schizophrenia. Think about those diseases for a minute. They are surprisingly common in the population, but are they exclusively environmental? We know they're not exclusively genetic. They don't just simply get passed on from generation to generation in the way that a muscular dystrophy or cystic fibrosis or hemophilia is. But clearly there is some families that are more at risk than others. Alzheimer's disease is another good example to put in that list. And in many of these cases, there are rare forms of each disease that is clearly genetic. It does have a sort of a very familial dependence. And there are other cases where it would appear there are genetic susceptibility factors that some people have and other people don't that may put them more at risk for developing MS or diabetes or Parkinson's disease, to name just a few examples, compared to other people in the population. And we have to find out what those genetic risk factors are. And now that we have the human genome sequence and we have a catalog not just of the genes but of all the sites in our DNA that vary frequently from one person to another, now we have the tools to do that. Now we just have to do the studies. In order to do those studies, many people are focusing on very specific populations. I mentioned Graham Bell, his study on diabetes using a relatively homogeneous population in Texas. Other companies are going out and looking at the population in Iceland or in Asia or Micronesia or isolated islands around the world, where the genetics is kind of simplified because it's a very homogeneous population, and it allows you to kind of focus in on one or two genes that may be involved. A great example.
Pardon me for jumping in. I should not have asked such a complicated question right at the end, because unfortunately we're at the end of the time and we're going to have to stop. Much more in the book that I mentioned, Cracking the Genome by Kevin Davis, published by Free Press. There we'll have to stop. Mr. Davis, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having me.